Good day, and welcome to the ESPN Media Conference Call with MLB insider Kylie McDaniel. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I turn the conference over to Katie Hughes. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Katie Hughes. I'm the senior publicist for MLB's coverage on ESPN. Thank you for joining today's media conference call with ESPN insider and draft expert Kylie McDaniel. Kylie joined ESPN this year, providing his expert analysis on prospects, the draft, free agency, among other things. He began working with MLB teams in 2005, scouting and recording and working in front offices, and just this past April published his first book, which is called Future Value. Kylie's a signature part of ESPN's upcoming presentation of the 2020 MLB Draft, June 10th and 11th, which will include nearly 10 hours of live coverage over the course of the 2 days, including cameras with GMs or select personnel of all 30 teams and one-on-one interviews with top prospects. Kylie's first two mock drafts, plus his top players available in 2020 and beyond, are currently available for ESPN Plus subscribers. With that, I'll turn it over to Kylie to give a quick intro on what to expect in this year's draft, and then we'll begin with some questions. Kylie?
Yeah, thanks, Katie. The broad stuff going on right now is everyone is expecting Spencer Torkelson to go first overall to Detroit, and then there's a big question at number two with Baltimore, who are run by Mike Elias, who used to run the Astros. Obviously, they went underslot at 1-1 to take Carlos Correa and then spend the savings in other places, and so that's sort of where the amount of certainty in the industry kind of cuts off. And my next and final mock draft will be on the morning of the draft. So between now and then, I'll be working the phones. I got one scheduled for right when we're done here. And I would say the other sort of like, 30,000-foot view would be teams are telling me that they have drastically reduced the amount of high school players that they are willing to meet the price for. So in the case of even players that have multi-year history, we're good over the summer, sort of check all the boxes. If they just didn't see him this spring or they didn't have higher level scouts see them this spring, they're just not going to pay them what they thought they were going to pay them if they could have seen them for maybe one more month. So there's going to be a lot of college players getting pushed up, and the high school players that are in demand that everyone feels comfortable with will go quickly in those first 30 to 50 picks. And then I think it'll be even more college heavy than it is normally. So with that, I guess we can head into your questions.
Great. Thanks, Kylie. We're going to go ahead and start with Evan Petzold of the Detroit Daily News with Steve Mims on deck.
How's it going? Thanks for doing this. Just a couple quick questions about the Tigers and what, you think they're going to do. I mean, can you kind of make a case for Torkelson, Martin, and even Lacy as well, at that number one spot? Can you make a case?
Yeah, I have, I don't think we've published this yet, but I put sort of a top 100 rankings, for the top three. I find that's like an easy way for, the more casual fan to understand where these guys are. Currently I have Torkelson 19th, Martin 36th, and Lacy 47th. So obviously from 19th to 47th on a top 100 is like a little bit of a gap, enough that you can notice a difference, and there's probably a industry consensus from the top guy to the bottom guy. But also if you can, save $1.5 million, $2 million on a, bonus, you could then make up that gap by saying, hey, the second guy we get is going to be in the top 100 and, a year from now. And the other guy we'd get if we paid full freight, maybe wouldn't be. So I think it's close enough that it can come down to money. And, so from Detroit's perspective, I've written this a couple times, but they prefer, and they've like said this, I think even on the record, but they've definitely said it a lot privately and their actions sort of, back it up. Is they prefer SEC performance, like specifically that, the best conference, and power bats and power arms. And so Martin's not a huge power bat now. He might be down the road, but he'll never be a huge power bat. Obviously, Torkelson is a power bat, but he's Pac-12. And then Lacy is a power arm SEC. So he fits their preferences a little bit better than the other two guys, even though he's generally seen as the third best prospect amongst these guys. But again, it's, very close. And my sources have told me that they see Torkelson as the best prospect. They're probably going to take Torkelson, but Lacy is their second best prospect. And they're also sort of considering it because they think they're closer than most teams think they are. But also sort of reading the tea leaves on what the bonus demands may be. So from Lacy's perspective, it's 3+ pitches. You could argue maybe even 270 pitches and a 60 pitch on the 20-80 scale. 270s and a 60 is essentially a frontline starter, depending on what the command ends up being. you could squint and look at like the arsenals of guys in the big leagues and say, you know, Max Scherzer, Steven Strasburg, it's like that sort of upside if it all comes together. The command is the issue right now and has to iron out the delivery some. So if you believe you're getting a frontline pitcher and there's only 8 or 10 of them on earth at a given time, you really have to look at Lacy. But the sort of risk to getting him to reach his command potential, holding his stuff, staying healthy, being healthy for 200 something innings for a long time, it's just a lot of things you have to get through, which is why pitchers are seen as a riskier demographic. And then Torkelson, I think it's pretty clear, you know, whatever you want to believe Pete Alonso is, where it's, you know, above average contact, above average pitch selection, plus plus power, maybe 40 home runs. He's done everything he can do as an amateur. The performance record is, you know, sterling. And then Martin, who I don't think is an option for Detroit, but the reason he would be up there is because of the track record of hitting and having elite pitch selection in the SEC, multi-positional guy, gives you all kinds of margin for error, which a lot of teams, especially ones running on statistical modeling, are looking for. That the, you know, the tool that matters is the hit tool, and he's the best in the draft. And so you're sort of hanging your hat on that. And he's given teams some different looks in the spring in terms of like how quick he is, what position he can play, how much power they think he'll get you, you know, in the short term. But long term, I think there's potential for a Ben Zobrist, Justin Turner type player. So you could see a team talking themselves into that as well.
For sure. And just jumping off that really quick, I mean, I know you kind of mentioned it a couple times now, but just to get your expanded thoughts on it, do you consider, you know, Torkelson a lock for the Tigers at number one? If so, why? And then kind of a second part to that is, you know, after that first pick is over, I mean, what do you expect the Tigers to do afterward in the later rounds?
I mean, Torkelson has been described to me as at least 90% likely to go to Detroit. I think it's probably more like 98%. His advisor, Scott Boras, is not going to give them a number before the draft, so there's not going to be a true draft deal. So it's definitely not 100, but it is hard to imagine them not taking him, and all the indications coming from their camp and, you know, people close to that camp is that it's not really an actual conversation. There would have to be something really drastic to happen that I don't foresee happening. In the second round, if they take Torkelson, they'll be able to save a little bit off the slot the way that the slots are set up. Like all those first couple picks, the teams will sign for slightly below. The issue is there's a lot of teams in the comp round that have multiple picks that are targeting specific high school players. And there's teams picking, you know, like 30, 31, 32 who are not sure who's going to get to them. And so Detroit, obviously, you know, picking in the second round for the next pick, there's no way to know who it's going to be. But the sort of policy most teams have is you don't try to cut a deal and save money up top to then spend later if you have one player targeted, because you can't guarantee he'll get there. Even if you've done everything you can do, there might be one team just say, you know what, we'll just take him anyway and see what happens. If he doesn't sign, he doesn't sign. You have to provide for 3, 4, 5 players. And in the event that they take Torkelson, pay him close to slot, and a bunch of other teams have either cut money or have multiple picks and have more money, Detroit then wouldn't have the sort of hammer to pick whichever high school player they want. So I would say they probably have a group of people in mind. If they take Torkelson, and it probably includes a good bit of college players, and if they cut and take Lacy at one, then I think they're going to have a group that includes more unsignable high school or harder to sign high school players to target, because then they'll have sort of the bonus hammer to kind of float down to their pick who they want. But there's a lot of teams with a lot of money in between their two picks, so they don't have a lot of control over it right now.
For sure. Awesome. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Evan. Now I'm going to talk to Steve Mintz of the Eugene Register Guard with Lynn Worthy on deck.
Yeah. Hey, Kylie. Thanks for doing this. I had a question about two players, if you think they'll be drafted or not. One of them is Oregon pitcher Kenyon Yovan, who kind of emerged as a hitter as well this spring, and a thought if he could be drafted, and if so, at pitcher or hitter. And the other is the Mississippi prep Robbie Ashford, who's might fall in your category of too high of a price to pay since he's got a commitment to play football at Oregon.
Yeah, Yovan is in that area. I'm finalizing my rankings for, I published 1 through 150 on ESPN.com, and that'll stay static. I'm kind of working through 151 to 250, since I think there'll be a lot of unsigned high school players, so we'll need an extra 100 guys more than the picks we have for sort of the best available at the bottom of the screen on the broadcast. Yovan is in the mix to be on that list. The issue with him is he looked like a, call it second or third round pick a couple summers ago as a pitcher. He got hurt. The stuff never came back. He hasn't really pitched very much. He has plus power, but it's not a super long track record of hitting. It's probably like a first base left field sort of fit in pro ball. And so that kind of guy with some power, but not a long track record of hitting. He's now older. It's not clear what the history or what the future is on the mound, because it sort of comes down to what teams are getting with their medical, which, because of HIPAA laws, like, you know, I'll get some little bits of nuggets here and there, but all 30 teams aren't telling me what they think about these guys. So I would say he's probably in that 50-50 to get selected sort of area. There's hundreds and hundreds of players, obviously, in that area. And the good news for him and guys like him, where there are, you know, maybe, you know, injury markers that would make a team hesitate, you only need one team to take it. You don't need all 30 to vote on you and, you know, get you on the island or whatever. So, yeah, he's got a decent shot to be drafted. And I would probably say it'd be more hitter. But if a team takes him, I think they would always leave that route open to see if he can get healthy enough to get back on the mound and sort of, you know, look like a power relief type. On Ashford, he is a model-friendly player in that he's 17 on draft day, and there are certain teams, Cleveland is the big example, that really move guys up the board based on that. And if you look at the high school hitters they've taken specifically in the first couple rounds, it's almost always 17-year-olds. He didn't have a long track record of hitting. He was pretty good at East Coast Pro, which is the big event he was at, and he showed all the tools you need to show. He was a little more polished than some were expecting. So I don't specifically know. I'll probably find out in the next few days what his sort of number is and what his representation thinks that his odds are. But just the buzz from teams for the last week or so is, you know, there's some questions around college football. It's not the slam dunk that it once was. If there's some now money in baseball, if some teams like him a little more than the average team does, and there's seven figures, like, that might be a little more attractive than it was before. So I think he looked like a probably no before the pandemic, and now I think it's slowly turning into a maybe, and I might have a better answer for you a little closer to draft day.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yep.
Thank you, Steve. Now I'm going to talk to Lynn Worthy of the Kansas City Star with Mike Persa on deck.
Hey, Kylie. I was interested in which of the, in your opinion, on which of the pitchers is the best prospect in this draft, and whether or not Hancock is sort of dropped in the eyes of the evaluators, if he may have been more of a consensus top guy before the year, if that has changed, or your view on that?
Yeah, I would say he was the consensus top guy coming into the year. I think, you know, it was maybe 60-40 him versus Lacy. The issue was that Hancock did not pitch last summer, and it was pretty limited this fall. And so scouts were rushing in to see him preseason the week before the season started. And as you could see from his line when he faced, I believe it was Richmond, was the opener that I was at, he wasn't very good there. And I found out later that his stamina hadn't been built up yet. So the issue with him is similar to one that I've talked about with Trey Turner in the past, which is Trey Turner was fantastic at NC State as a freshman and sophomore, but he wasn't eligible, so scouts weren't watching him. Like, they knew, maybe they were watching a game he was in, but they weren't paying attention to him. They knew his stats, they knew their reputation, but they hadn't sort of formed an answer. And then by the time it was time for scouts to watch him, it was in the summer, he was battling through an injury with Team USA, didn't look quite as good as his double play partner, Alex Bregman. And then in the spring, he was tinkering with a swing, and some scouts are like, I've seen him three times now, last summer and early this spring, I don't like him anymore, I'm out. And then he looked really good down the stretch, and if you'd seen him as a freshman and sophomore, you'd stay on him, and you'd know to stay on him. Hancock is similar to that he was very good. I ran into him as a freshman, and like, all the scouts were looking at each other. We were there to see other players, and we're like, wow, this guy's the best guy on the field by a mile. And he looked like that all through his freshman year, early in his sophomore year. Then there was some arm soreness, and he wasn't quite himself toward the end, didn't pitch in the summer. That's when the scouts started showing up. He wasn't there. And then preseason was good, not great. And then early in the season, your first real game look at him, he wasn't that great. And when he was about to hit his stride and get into lead play, he didn't get to do it. So there is a little bit of sort of unfair slicing of when scouts were seeing him. But the other issue is there has been some arm soreness in the past, so scouts are teams are waiting to see how that medical looks, which I think is coming out to him, came out to him last week. I haven't heard anything super negative about it, but obviously there's a little bit of a worry there. And also, I've mentioned in the past, teams are generally looking for four-seam, quote, rising fastballs in general, because there's more swing and miss, gives you more margin for error, and high-spin curveballs. Hancock doesn't have either of those. And so what you're hanging your hat on is sort of history, the body, the delivery, the arm action, the changeup. Teams also don't tend to love right-handed starters that are changeup over breaking ball, which he is. So he's a little bit of a you know, old-school pitcher, and that he doesn't fit a lot of the recent trends, and he hasn't been seen recently. And so teams that are a little more traditional in their evaluation and are, you know, leaning to the scouting side, and that they had multi-year history with him and have really stayed on top of him, they're going to like him more than other teams. I think it's hard to say he's the top pitcher right now when Lacy both was good lately. was good on the best stage and also fits sort of where the trends are going and what's most valued in baseball right now. And I would also say Max Meyer is, you know, some teams may have him ahead of Hancock as well. He's up to 100 with an 80 grade top of the grade or top of the scale slider. And he also sort of fits today's game in that he may be a Lance McCullers type where it may not be 200 innings, but if it turns out he's a little more durable than that, he might be Walker Buehler. And so it sounds like there's a number of teams in the top 10 that have Meyer ahead of Hancock as well. And we could look back on this and say that this was a little hint that Hancock was sort of not as good as he appeared as a freshman, and this was just a glimpse ahead of time, or it could turn out he turns into Luis Castillo and we all feel silly because we talked ourselves out of it.
Yeah, I also wanted to ask you, Zach Veen, what sort of upside do you see there? What sort of a comp do you have for him as obviously a long high school hitter who some teams are talking about, I guess there are some draft projections to talk about maybe even as high as 2. Is that realistic in your mind?
I think his most likely spots are 4 and 5 and then probably 8 to San Diego would be sort of the, you know, the bottom for him. I think his upside is huge to sort of, I wouldn't say lazy, but the easy comp to throw on would be Cody Bellinger because the swing looks similar. He's obviously not projected to be Cody Bellinger. There's also some similarities to Christian Yelich, who I think they did look somewhat similar at the same stage. The issue is that Veen has a much more projectable body, whereas Yelich hasn't even really completely filled out to the level some people thought. Veen looks like some scouts have him maybe moving to first base eventually. So while he was a plus runner and center fielder over the summer, he already looks like a right fielder now. And some scouts think he'll move to first base eventually, but right field at least. The difference is the upside is to have above average to plus hit, above average to plus pitch selection, and plus power, which is at least as good as Torkelson, maybe a little better. But we just don't have the sort of certainty of all of this college performance that Torkelson has. So that's the reason he's getting talked about that high, is you could have a guy with even more offensive potential than Torkelson that also can play right field and is just an overall better prospect. But it's going to take a couple of years to find out if that's the case. And obviously there's a good bit of risk between here and there. So, yeah, that's the reason he's being talked about it as high as 2. And I think he's probably going to go 4th or 5th.
And the last one I have is just Nick Gonzalez. I take it the hit tool seems like the one that's carrying it for him. And do you see enough there for it to make him a top 4 pick potentially?
Yeah, I think he's also in play at 2. I think he also goes probably 4, 5, or 6. The profile is not super different than Austin Martin. The difference is Martin is a better runner, has a little more experience and defensive value at different positions, and has a long track record of hitting in the SEC. Whereas the raw tools are about the same for Gonzalez, maybe not quite as good defensively. The problem is he's been playing at New Mexico State, and so you kind of have to throw those numbers out at some level because it's poor competition, it's at elevation, it's small parks. You know, it's obviously not wood bats, but he had a really good performance on the Cape. And so that sort of month, essentially, is what scouts are hanging their hat on. And so you could see a team squinting and saying, hey, we didn't like Martin this spring. We think maybe he's not quite as good as what's hyped coming into the year. We think Gonzalez is a little better than people think because we're really focusing on the Cape and we think he's been unfairly maligned for the New Mexico State stuff. Like, that's just where he played and he did everything he could do there. He's putting up bonkers numbers nonstop. So you could see somebody seeing those guys as pretty close. And for example, Baltimore too, taking Gonzalez, getting some savings and then spending that money elsewhere. But the general view is that Martin is, you know, second or third, has a little more upside, a little more certainty. And then Gonzalez is, you know, anywhere from 4 to 6, maybe 7 on an overall list. But I don't think he'll get out of the top 6 or 7 because, just, you know, college bats with tools and performance, there's just not that many of them.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Now we're going to move on to Mike Persha of the Pittsburgh Post with Mark Topkin on deck.
Hey, Kelly, I appreciate you doing this. I want to ask you about the Pirates, where they sit in the draft, kind of, you know, where you see their needs and where you think that they might be leading with that number 7 pick and even maybe beyond.
They're in a tough spot, obviously, as a sort of rebuilding or reloading, you know, smaller revenue, smaller payroll team, also with the new regime in play. So, I mean, they really need to just restock the farm system, and I think ideally it would be guys that will be there in the next 2 or 3 years so that they can, you know, sort of from today start loading up toward their next playoff team and not have a guy that's, you know, 5 or 6 years away, like multiple years in rookie ball. But luckily in the top 10, there's not really prospects like that. Like, even the high school guys are expected to move quickly. That's where I would expect them to look college with their second, third picks when those guys are options. I don't think the needs really come into play here. I think it's just who's the best prospects. And I think lucky for them, they'll have their choice of high school pitchers. There's some buzz that Nick Abelman is at least being considered there, which was not the case, according to the industry about a week or two ago, but now it sounds like he's a real option there as the sort of consensus top high school pitcher. They will have a shot at probably all of the high school hitters except for Zach Veen. And then what everyone in the industry kind of thinks they're going to do is they're looking college hitter for the reasons I'd outlined before. And that Heston Kerstad at Arkansas, who looks reminiscent of J.J. Bleday, who went third overall last year out of Vanderbilt. And then also Patrick Bailey, who's the best catcher in the draft, is also, if he doesn't go seven, would probably go in the next couple picks. The catching actually probably is the biggest weakness in the system. So if they're kind of flipping a coin there, going catcher may be the choice for that. So I would expect them to go college hitter, but it sounds like they're considering all aspects because, like I said, at the top of the draft, you're not getting those two-year rookie ball guys. Even the high school kids are going to move pretty quickly.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike. Now, Mark Topkin from the Tampa Bay Times with Spencer Morris on deck.
Hey, Kylie. Thanks for doing this. Two questions. One is, obviously, every team is impacted by the five-round limit, but a team like the Rays that is so draft-dependent on getting low-cost talent has had a lot of success in the lower rounds. Do you think it impacts them or hurts them more?
Yeah, I think the teams that are probably hurt the most are the ones that have sort of demonstrated an ability to both have bigger staffs, better processes as sort of graded by the industry, and then better results, especially outside of the first few rounds. I think the Rays are clearly above average amateur scouting operation. They, embrace both the scouting and having a big scouting staff and sort of the modeling and the stats and things like that. I would throw them up there with, the Dodgers, the Yankees, some of the groups that have done the best in the draft. And so some of those teams, like I know going back to when I worked for the Braves, it was just expected you would find at least one big leaguer per draft after the 10th round. Maybe you wouldn't, but you'd get close. Maybe a guy you could trade for a big leaguer. There'd be like some sort of value was expected, and not every team expects that because not every team has a track record of doing that, and the Rays are one of those teams. So, all of those $125,000 bonus guys after the 10th round to a lot of teams are just sort of, not that important, and the teams where it is important, they'll sign more of them because there's a track record of turning them into prospects.
Gotcha. And then the other question is, I know it's always a rolling scale on how you evaluate drafts, but the Rays did make some significant changes in their processes a couple of years ago. They seem to have been doing better based on what the experts have said. Do you agree with that they have gotten better? And if so, why do you think so?
Yeah, there was a change in regime. I don't remember how many years ago it was, but there was that run where they had a bunch of extra picks every year and the results were not very good. And I don't think that was necessarily because the process was bad. I think there was probably some bad decisions and some bad luck as well. But it looked especially stark given that there were so many extra picks and the expectations are so much higher. It does seem like in the last couple of years that there probably has been some adjustments to the process. The outcomes have gotten much better. And like I said, I think the balancing of the sort of progressive and traditional methods together tends to get the best results. There's not a lot of teams that are on either end all the way to the edge that are getting the best results. And so if that sounds like where Tampa is, and I think that's also another reason why their farm system is so good, and thus their top executives keep getting poached because they from top to bottom across all these different departments. In the book, actually, Eric and I outlined that we think they may be the best-run organization in baseball because the other two sort of candidates for that were the Yankees and the Dodgers, who obviously have way more money. So the fact that the Rays are even in that conversation with so many fewer resources seems to be like a very good reason why, when all things being equal, their executives are getting poached because the process seems to be a little bit better.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. I have Spencer Morris from fishstripes.com with Stephen Loftus on deck.
Hi, Kylie. I appreciate your time. I just had a couple kind of specific questions about a few players. The first one was Mason Winn, just kind of what chances he has to be tried as a two-way player in the pros, and then also kind of his odds to make it in that capacity. And then also Dylan Dingler is a guy who's risen a lot this year, unique tools at the catcher position. I'm just wondering how the confidence level is in his bat going forward.
So Wynn actually, you know, maybe Mark should hang on for this one. I wrote in a piece I think we have going up either tomorrow or next week when they said, you know, pair a player with a team, sort of like a dream scenario. And I thought Tampa Bay would be a very good fit for Mason Wynn because he is getting looked at by teams in the late first round to early second round. I think he'll probably go off by pick 50 as a two-way player. The quick rundown on the tools, it's a seven-arm, seven-runner, above-average power, chance to be an above-average hitter, electric, twitchy shortstop from a high school kid from Texas, which on its own is probably enough to go in the first 50 picks. On the mound, he might have 270 pitches, which is, you know, arguably better than Ace Lacy, who's the top pitcher in the draft. The issue is he's a righty. There's some effort. He might be a reliever, shorter guy, probably not a 200-inning guy. But the fact that he's that good both ways, the Rays have obviously taken a player like Tanner Dodson, Brendan McKay, obviously the Angels with Otani, William Holmes. San Diego had Christian Betancourt just traded with the Rays for Drake Cronenworth, who also was two-way. So there's a handful of teams that have demonstrated an ability to both look for tools and upside, which Mason Wynn definitely is. Sounds like teams prefer him as a shortstop, that they'll send him out that way, and then the decision is, do you want him to pitch at all? And so I think the teams that like upside are picking in that range and have shown an ability or an interest in developing two-way players. Luckily, there's a couple of them in that range right there. So, I think you're onto something there. What was the other question?
Just about Dylan Dingler. Obviously, the tools really stand out at the catcher position. I'm just wondering the confidence in his bat.
Yeah, so I've been talking to people about that a lot the last couple of weeks because his raw tools are almost the same as Joey Bart's, who went second overall to Georgia Tech recently. The issue with Bart was he was a guy at high school that might have gotten $1 million, and so the track record of sort of hitting, watching him catch, getting the reps, all that sort of stuff was very high. And by the time he was a junior in college, he was already a plus defender. You could send him straight to the big league. That's the reason he's moving so fast. But the concern with Bart was it's power over hit. What if he ends up being a 220 hitter that strikes out a lot? Does all this stuff matter, having all this power, if he's not going to get to it in games? Dingler's a similar player, but he is new to catching. So he has all the tools, I think, to be as good as Bart is. He probably won't be just because, you know, the reps aren't there. He's getting started later. But the arm, the athleticism, the body, the movements, everything is all very similar behind the plate. It's just a little more on the raw side of the athleticism. Also, the power is maybe one. I'd say Bart is probably 65, maybe 70 raw power. Dingler's a 60. It's like not that far behind. The issue is that Dingler does not have a history of making tons of contact. It's not that he has a history of swinging and missing. It just doesn't have that history. He didn't play over the summer. He was rehabbing an injury. He just converted to catching. A lot of times catching will wear on a guy's offensive ability. So there's still questions about exactly what the impact will be. But, I mean, the upside is a guy that should be going in the top five if maybe he had an entire season and just, you know, massacred the Big Ten, which I think some people were expecting. But he was at the top of every scout's, at least national scout's, like 2C list at the beginning of the year. So he had, you know, a handful of weekends. I saw him one weekend against Georgia Tech when he wasn't that great contact-wise. I was told the weekend before in Tampa or in Florida, I think it was Fort Myers, that he looked great. And so it was a short enough window that if you saw him once, you might have gotten him good or bad. And if you're the loudest voice in your room, that might move him down five or six slots so you then don't pick him. But I'd expect him to go, you know, somewhere around 20th.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Spencer. We have Stephen Loftus from Baltimore Sports and Life up with Tony Paul on deck.
Hi, Kylie. First off, of course, thank you for the time that you're putting into this and the work that you're putting out there. So I have two questions, one of them very specific to this draft and then one a little bit kind of 30,000 feet longer term. So I'll start with the more specific. In the last, you know, a week or so, there's been a lot more talk about the Orioles going underslot at two with, you know, Mike Elias's Houston background, all of that sort of thing. Should they go that route, who do you necessarily see or who might have you have heard as targets for overslot at number 30 for the Orioles?
So this goes back to the, I guess, the common question that if the team's picking in the top 10, if there's a discussion of going under or if they have a comp pick or if they have, you know, maybe, you know, two picks later in the round. How are they going to balance it? So I'm not going to endorse that this is the way that Baltimore will do it because this is technically against MLB rules, but I can tell you every team does it, which is, let's say you're picking, you know, let's say hypothetically we are, you know, team 31, we're ESPN conference call. We're picking first and we're picking 30th. What's going to happen is we pick guy first and say we go under slot. We take the non-consensus best player. We save $2 million. So our slot later is $2 million. We've saved $2 million, so we have $4 million to spend. Well, the slot for $4 million is, say, like 12th overall, something like that. So once the 12th pick comes off, you see who's still on the board and who do you like. High school players are easier to move because obviously they can say, I want to go to school. They have some leverage, so they're easier to move. Ideally, the parents will be rich because a lot of guys in the past, Daz Cameron, Jack Leiter, guys like that, the guys that have slipped are not signed. It's because the dad's independently wealthy, so when a kid said he doesn't want to sign, people will believe him. It's not always fair. That's how it works. Or at least works sometimes. Other times it can work a different way. So what happens is if the slot is $4 million at pick 12, we have $4 million to spend. Once pick 12 is over, we see who's available. All right, we like these three high school guys. We can't get all three of them to our pick, but what we do is call all three of them and say, we've got $4 million for you. If you're not the next pick, you're going to lose money. If you let them pick you, tell them that you want $5 million. This is essentially what teams do. I'm not going to say any team has done it in any certain scenario or they're going to do it this time, but this is broadly what happens. Is you let the draft play out. If the player Elias wanted at 30 ends up going 12th overall, let's say if Nick Bixigo is one guy that's been rumored for them to be going after, if he goes 12, he can't control that. And I've heard instances of this where a team thinks they can get a guy to the 30s and he just goes, you know, 10th to 12th to 15th. And, you know, if the slot's comparable to what you were offering and it's a high pick and it's now, they can't take the risk that trying to get to your pick, they end up going 25th and they're forced to sign for that slot. They're giving money away. Like the kid's taking on a risk too. So unfortunately, that's why I've said before, as you know, Baltimore, whichever team is trying to do this, you have to target four or five players ahead of time. And then once you get to where the slot that you can offer has already been passed in the draft, then maybe you can be down to two or three of them and say, okay, let's tell them all to throw out a huge number of teams. Let's hope the teams believe them. Let's hope they pass. Let's hope they all get here. Probably one of them will get there. So all that to say, I can't tell you who a great target is because they're not going to know who a great target is. If I had to pick out a few guys, I would say once you get down to about 20th on my rankings, I think Abel and Bitsko are probably going to be gone by then. I think Pete Crow Armstrong will probably be gone by then, but there's a chance you could float him down there as a Harvard Westlake Vanderbilt kid. And then below that, it's just a bunch of college pitching. And so then you get down into the mid to late 20s, and you've got Jared Kelly, Tanner Witt, Jordan Walker, Carson Tucker, Mason Wynn. All those guys might get there on merit. So that's more wait until pick 22 if somebody's not on than get them to float a number. But a lot of these guys have already been rumored to be going into 30s, and they're already throwing out a big number because they think they might get more money there. So unfortunately, to answer your question, I don't think Baltimore can do anything too proactive right now because there's too many things that can happen in front of them, and maybe a guy they think gets into the 30s is going to sign for slot at 21. They probably can't affect that because if a guy's going to sign for slot 21, there's probably a team that wants to pay him slot at 23 and 25 and 26, and you can't get all three of them to pass, especially this year when I think some teams are just going to offer 70% of slot, not call ahead and ask if the kid's going to sign and just tell them, hey, are you really going to turn down $2.5 million? That doesn't happen very much. This year it will happen more than it has in the past, and that will affect plans for teams like this.
Okay, I say thanks for that. The second one kind of deals with the drafts going forward. You mentioned about the Rays getting their balance or striking a balance between traditional scouting and the modern analytical predictive modeling that goes on. With the pandemic, the decrease in scouting, the furloughing of many members of the front office, all of that sort of thing, and the uncertainty about, you know, possibly contracting the minor leagues a little bit, shorter drafts going forward, is there any possibility or is there a chance, what type of chances are there that front offices see scouting departments possibly has targets of opportunity and really cutting back on area scouts or, you know, limiting things to national cross-checker or regional cross-checker type of individuals?
I think that's where things were headed before this, and I think a lot of people have referred to this as sort of an accelerant of that, that if teams are going to generally get more information, be it data or reports or easy events to attend put together by MLB as a way to sort of save money for teams and sort of standardize information, make it more of an even playing field. That is, I don't think that is MLB, and they sort of told me that's not their intention, but in the way of doing that to sort of serve the teams and make it easier for them, they make the scouts less valuable because then that's, you know, fewer players for scouts to go discover. There's fewer looks where there's only one or two teams there where the scout can make his presence felt and make a difference for his team. So I think this stuff, the pandemic is going to there's going to be some furloughs and teams are going to be forced to do a thing in terms of relying more on data than reports than they have in the past that they wouldn't have done. Now they're forced to do it and some teams are going to realize, hey, you know, the information is not quite as good, but we're okay with this. Let's try that again one more year and see if we're actually okay with it. There's also some teams that are aggressively trying to do this And this gives them the PR cover of being able to do it otherwise. So, yeah, there is some worry in the industry that this will both give an excuse and give a window into what things will look like. I think most people think that there is still a lot of value in scouting, but the issue is then, will an owner think that saving, you know, $1.5 million on scouts and expenses and benefits and travel and all that sort of stuff, is it worth having slightly worse information? If every team does it, then it probably is. But I don't think you'll ever get every team going that far. But I think a lot of teams will see that mass and make a decision that way, which is, I think, a shame for the game. And I think it's probably the wrong thing to do. But it also increases the value of good scouts, because then if every team only has, you know, 6 or 8 scouts instead of 15, then those 6 or 8 that everybody wants are going to get paid more. And there's also going to be more money to hand out. So it's always a bit of a silver lining. But I think the hordes of scouts that you see at games, there's been sort of like gallows humor at some of these events, like, hey, 10 years from now, there might be, you know, 40 scouts here instead of 200 at, you know, area codes or some of these big events. And I think, unfortunately, scouts have seen that coming for a long time, and this may speed it up. And I still don't think it's the right answer, but I think that's sort of the direction we're heading in, and I'm kind of curious to see how it's going to play out and how some teams react to it.
Okay. Thank you, Kylie. Thank you again.
Thank you, Stephen. I'm going to move on to Randy Miller from NJ.com with Chris Boyle on deck.
Hi. Couple quick ones. What do you see the Yankees' philosophy in the draft this year? I've seen a lot of mock drafts have them going for college pitchers. Also wondering what you think of their pick last year. If you can look back, they took the high school kid from Jersey, Anthony Volpe.
Yeah, the Yankees, I think, are another team similar to how I spoke about the Rays earlier, where they really, I think, fully embrace all the different methods of evaluation, having a big staff, you know, going into the biometrics and the, you know, mechanical analysis, in addition to the sort of statistical modeling and the scouting and having the staff that brings you more names. Like, whenever you hear there's a rising high school player and only a couple teams are on them, and I ask which teams, the Yankees are always one of the teams that comes up, because they just seem to be on top of that stuff and have a big enough staff that can allow for those sorts of things. So I think in this case, I've heard them tied to a lot of players. I think most of them are going to go in like the 15 to 20 sort of area and not get to their pick. But the reason they're tied to college pitching is because that's what's available. If you just look at my rankings, once you get past like 20, so, you know, presumably somewhere after 20, you're looking at players that may be available at their pick. It's mostly pitching and it's mostly college pitching. And so they're getting tied to that because that's what's there. And they, I think, have a pretty good track record in each demographic of those, you know, 4 major hitter, pitcher, college, high school, picking out the kind of guys they like. And, you know, taking Clint Schmidt as an injured college pitcher in the past in the first round, like, they're obviously not scared of doing anything like that. I don't think they love taking high school pitchers up top. I think they'd rather take them lower and spread out the risk a little bit because it's a risky demographic. But some teams will not take them, and the Yankees are not one of those teams. Going to Volpe, I think he's one of those players where it's not huge, loud tools. It's not a big projectable frame. It's not, you know, upside to the ceiling. It is very good feel for the game, track record of hitting, figure stuff out, performs, you know, heady player, all those different sorts of things that have become cliches. There's a reason they're cliches, is sometimes you not necessarily take the intangibles before the tools, because Volpe has tools. But when you have a not as big shortstop, which is sort of in vogue now, but doesn't have the power ceiling, it's sort of seen as like a lower upside pick, and it is. But there's obviously guys in the big leagues that are, you know, 5'8 hitting home runs. That doesn't preclude him from potentially turning into that sort of guy. But yeah, I think he could be a top 100 prospect if he is performing in probably, once he gets to high A, double A, right around there. That'll be enough time to, I think, demonstrate that all of these sort of secondary skills, feel for the game, things like that, are strong enough to be a potential everyday player in the big leagues. Like, that's when we'll know enough to see his performance to know if that's how these things are playing.
One more. There's a kid named Patrick Riley, the top-ranked player out of Jersey, a Vanderbilt commit. Do you see him being drafted? And what do you like about him?
Yeah, he's in that big group of players that I think are probably like maybe late second round for some teams, probably more third to fourth round for most teams. Where the assumption is their price will not be met. Obviously, we see Vanderbilt, Eastern, the price goes up because that's such a desirable place, such a good education. So because he, you know, spring didn't start, he kind of popped onto the scene in the fall. So he came on very late. Jupiter is kind of where he popped up, hitting the mid-90s, you know, mature frame, pretty good breaking ball. I don't think he's the kind of guy that's going to get paid. I would say it's pretty low odds, maybe 25% or lower that he gets picked and signed. I would expect him to show up at Vanderbilt. And he's one of the guys that, in a 40-round draft where somebody can, you know, save a little money on each pick and then offer him $1.2 million in the 12th round. That's the kind of guy that normally would have a shot at getting signed, maybe get close to getting signed, have some, you know, conversations with teams in the ballpark that I think is going to have trouble, you know, getting those sorts of offers this year with just fewer picks and less money.
Thank you.
Thank you, Randy. We're running a little short on time, so I'm going to ask that everyone, for everyone to talk to Kylie, please limit to one question, and if we have time for a follow-up, we can go back around, or I can put you in touch with Kylie after this. So I'm going to go on to Chris Boyle from the Daytona Beach News Journal with Jason Caldwell on deck.
Hi, Kylie. I had two players I want to know kind of maybe the most likely scenarios for, the first being Zach Veen at the top of the draft from Spruce Creek High School, and the second being Logan Allen, the left-handed pitcher from Florida International.
Veen, I think the most likely option is either goes fourth or fifth. Those teams are both on him. They both have, you know, good reports. The room likes him. They like the upside. And he's also got, you know, gives them a full year of performance to go off of, which in the case of Dylan Dingler from Ohio State, the college player that we talked about earlier, you don't really have a year of history with him of being heavily scouted. So in some ways he's seen as having more history and certainty than some college players. Logan Allen gave scouts, both in terms of data and visual looks, a better look this year. The velocity was a little bit better. The curveball was a little bit sharper. They already knew he could pitch, had a good changeup, and, you know, had all the sort of different command aspects in play. So while I think coming into the year, I probably would have had him around 50 or 60 overall, probably go in the second round, there's now some buzz he might go in the 30s on day one, and I would expect him to be off the board by probably the mid-40s.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. I have Jason Caldwell from Inside the Auburn Tigers with Kevin Henry on deck.
Actually, yeah, Jason dropped off.
Okay, thank you. Then it'll be Kevin Henry with Clint Pistilis on deck.
Thanks so much, Kylie. Appreciate your time. And curious about the Rockies at number 9. I've seen them tied to both Kerstad and Detmers, and knowing what you've said already about college players, do you think that they're going to go with a college player, or what do you see them doing at number 9?
I had my latest mock. I had them taking Hancock. I think there's a chance he flips that far. I wouldn't say likely, but in the scenario I laid out there, he does get there. I think they would take him. I've said in the past that they specifically only draft players or pitchers that throw sinkers, given the ballpark, obviously. That's their sort of strategy to work around that. And we've seen some college pitchers specifically with sinkers drop in the mocks because a lot of teams are looking for the opposite sort of pitcher, all things being equal. And when there's a lot of pitchers available, you can obviously pick your flavor. So Chris McMahon with Miami, Carmen Majewski with South Carolina are also similar players where that's happening. And so they are presumably targets of Colorado in the comp and maybe into the second round. I think Hancock could be an option. I've heard that they are very interested in Robert Hassel. I think he goes 8th to San Diego, but I'm told if he doesn't go 8th to San Diego, there's a very good chance he goes 9th to Colorado. I also think another high school hitter they're on is Tyler Soderstrom out of Northern California. I think there's a chance that if Hancock and Hassel are both off the board, that he could be the option there. Detmers also was that sort of four-seam up in the zone guy. So it isn't necessarily their flavor of pitcher. I wouldn't say they'd throw them out completely, but I think it's a little less likely they go in that direction.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kevin. I have Clint Pistilis from Dodgers Nation with Tim Hugh on deck.
Say the last first name.
Clint Pistilis from Dodgers Nation.
Yeah, this is Clint. Everybody can hear me. I'm hoping right here. The Dodgers have 6 picks in this year's draft. Obviously, I'm going to keep this kind of Dodger-centric. We have number 29 overall in the first round. Looking at LA's depth chart, you know, it's a little tough to kind of point a finger at a major need, area of need. You have maybe left-handed pitching, maybe an athletic shortstop. You know, what are the insiders kind of feeling? What are you feeling about where they might be thinking for this year's shortened draft, and you know, where they might try to add for the already deep farm system, and moreover than that, what are maybe some names that fans should try to get to know better, you know, in a week's time? Maybe like we've heard, you know, Bobby Miller out of Louisville or Bryce Jarvis out of Duke.
Yeah, the Dodgers are another team, like both Tampa and the Yankees that I mentioned in the past, that they are sort of leveraged into every different position in terms of having a big staff, considering data, you know, kind of digging deep on the makeup on players, that sort of thing. So they are not opposed to any one demographic. It's hard to sort of pin them down, actually, until you hear specifically, hey, the Dodgers like this guy. So I think similar to what I said with the Yankees, since obviously the Dodgers are just a couple picks behind them, college pitching is looked at that pick. And so college pitching is probably the most likely thing because, you know, you got to kind of start throwing darts and there's a couple more college pitchers around than normal. Clayton Beter, if he can get there, I'm not sure he will, is their kind of guy in that he's coming off of Tommy John, which they're not scared of. And he has, according to some people, the best stuff in the entire draft. He was not a big name even on the first week of the season, but his TrackMan data came in after those handful of starts, which were not seen super widely by scouts. So I would keep an eye on Clayton Beter. I would also say that Cole Wilcox and Cade Cavalli out of Georgia and Oklahoma are both players that sort of show all the upside elements that teams are confident in their player development, which the Dodgers are one of them, that they can sort of not remake them, but sort of make the necessary adjustments more quickly than other teams would be good examples. I also think Bryce Jarvis could be interesting because his whole thing is he is completely optimized. He's 22. He'll probably sign for a discount. He is what these progressive teams would turn him into already. And so, I mean, some scouts are saying in a normal year, you could send him straight to high A or double A out of the draft, and you'll just know what you have very quickly. He'd become sort of an inventory piece quickly. And obviously teams that are contending can never have enough, like, inventory pitching, even if it ends up being a guy that pitches inning at a time during stretch run. And the last guy I would mention would be Jordan Westberg of Mississippi State. I believe Dodgers scouting director Billy Gasparino was with San Diego when they took Hunter Renfroe. Westberg is almost the same athlete, except he plays shortstop. They both have insane tools. It might be a seven runner with six raw power that can stick at shortstop. The contact is a little bit of a bugaboo, but he didn't have a lot of reps in high school. He didn't even go to events until he was a senior. Mississippi State was one of his only offers. He's been slowly improving. And he also fits their mold of going for upside kids with makeup, kids that have improved, and kids that probably need a little bit of player development help. They have one of the best groups to do that.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, Clint. I have Tim Hugh on the line from Bleed Cubby Blue with John Massey on deck.
Mine is a bit of a pivot, kind of on something that's come up a couple times already. Mark Topkin started it talking about the Rays, Dodgers, and Yankees being upper crust effectively. Do you see any teams approaching those, or do you see anybody who's maybe going escalator down a bit? Because getting the right name is important, but maximizing their value is more important.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. For the book, Eric and I noticed that Detroit has been, they were seen as sort of behind as recently as a year or two ago. We've noticed them doing a lot of different things with high-speed cameras, optimizing their pitchers, using data, things like that. So they're definitely moving in the right direction. I think San Diego has also seen, they're at the far end on sort of the traditional end of things, where they lean towards scouts, but they sort of do the best version of that. So I think they're probably in the upper crust of sort of a different flavor of things.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's another one that everyone agrees. Arizona has also been doing a very good job both internationally and domestically with that new group under Mike Hazen and Amil Sade, that they have sort of some specific types of players where they're looking for specific arm slots, spin rates, up the middle, contact guys. Like, I find the teams that have successfully targeted a sort of player and gotten good results with them, it's usually because they're just better at it in a way, and they kind of know where they're going to get good results. Yeah, and I also think Atlanta's draft, I think a lot of people in the industry were questioning some of their picks last year, and then by the time the summer had ended, it was very clear that they had an above-average draft, and they're also sort of taking what used to be a very traditional group and trying to make it more progressive. I think they're also doing some interesting things, and I would also say Minnesota is another one in that general area.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Tim. And finally, we have John Massey from the San Diego Union-Tribune.
Great, thank you. Kelly, if I could, a couple of players with San Diego ties who were getting a lot of buzz but weren't initially well thought of. Braden Olthoff, a right-handed pitcher out of Tulane, and a shortstop out of Carlsbad High School, Thomas Seghese. If are they anywhere on the horizon?
It's funny you mentioned that. It's almost like you've been going through my notes, because I think two of the names that I didn't even know a month ago that have been gotten the highest on my rankings that will be in the 150 to 151 to 250 area are those two guys. Sagisi, I had heard his name for the first time, I think, about 10 days ago, and then started asking around, and the eventual answer was, yeah, most teams know about him. Most teams are not really on him too high. He'll probably go to school, but he looked really good this spring. He had a handful of games, the sort of best teams, going back to this, you know, theme throughout this call, the teams that are really on top of guys, the first teams to get on guys when they pop up, they were mentioned yet again. And so there is some thought that he may go as high as the third round, as a handful of teams like him. He's signable. He's sort of a hit first, more average athlete, but good enough to play shortstop kind of player. And it's, you know, it's a handful of teams that I think feel that way about him, but it's probably enough for him to get picked. Olpop was brought up as a, when teams were kind of helping me out with, you know, who's going to be the highest draft pick that I haven't heard of because he's not a scouting guy. He popped up early. Maybe he's a TrackMan friendly guy. Olpop was a guy that came up. He works 88 to 93. Stuff's probably about average, but he's big. He throws strikes. He gets, great results. And I think, especially if teams got more looks at him during the spring, which they didn't, he could go as high as the third round. I think he's probably more fourth or fifth or a very good undrafted player that may or may not sign for the 20,000 afterwards, but he is now like on the radar for the draft, which before the season, I don't think he was even really on the radar for that kind of thing.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. And thank you all once again for joining us today. We will have a transcript and an audio recording forthcoming this afternoon following the call. If you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to me. My email address is Katie, K-A-T-I-E, dot Hughes, H-U-G-H-E-S, at ESPN.com. We're looking forward to ESPN's coverage of the 2020 MLB Draft, June 10th and 11th. Thank you so much, y'all. Have a great day. Take care.
And that does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.